Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show, and joining us as always, Andrew Malcolm, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com. Andrew, this is our first chance to talk since that State of the Union beat down on Democrats last week. I mean, that was something else, wasn't it?
Wasn't that amazing? It was. I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago about how lost the Democrats were, and that if they didn't look lost before then, they sure did after that address to the joint session. They don't know what to do. They're overwhelmed. There is no leadership. They don't have an alternative. Their only plan is criticize Trump, and 50% of the people voted for Trump, so that's not going to resonate too well, at least for now. They're just running around, bumping into each other, and holding up little signs and getting expelled. It's really sad, and not that I'm in favor of the Democrats, but a functioning democracy needs two parties. And these two are two of the three oldest ones in the world. And they became that way because they have the ability to morph. And that's how they survive. I mean, if a Democrat from the Kennedy days came and looked at this crowd, it wouldn't believe they're Democrats. The same for Republicans in some ways. So Democrats will come back. They'll morph into something else. They'll find something other than Trump. They better, because he's not going to be around forever.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he's got one term. That's it. He's constitutionally precluded from running again. And so if they expect to get things done, they got to do it really in the first 2 years, because you never know what the midterms are going to hold. But honestly, they just put out a list, I think, from the White House saying 50 wins in 50 days. And you go down that list and there are pretty significant things on that list. I mean, it's been a real blitz.
It really has. And Trump learned from his mistakes. He learned how to operate in Washington. He was a rookie in the first term. He knows how to operate. He's got a solid crew of loyalists this time. He's not relying on other people's recommendations. He's picking the people that he wants and knows. So they've overwhelmed him. They've got, I don't know how many dozen lawsuits, but he's been winning quite a few. In the first term, you remember when he wanted to do the wall, they tied him up for that, and then they tied him up over DACA. And this time he just came on, and what was it for the assault on Baghdad? Was it shock and awe?
Shock and awe. Yeah, shock and awe. That's kind of what happened in the first 2 months here. And it's kind of what happened on Tuesday night, too. Yeah. And I hate those things. You know, I hate State of the Union addresses. I just hate the phony pomp and circumstance and all that stuff. But I kind of enjoyed last Tuesday night, and I've been admitting to this, because it was sort of the gloves were off in both directions, right? House Democrats, Democrats in general, refused to accompany the president down the aisle. They refused to participate in that. And Donald Trump just let him have it from the dais, and they were trying to disrupt him from the floor. You know, Al Green shaking his walking stick and yelling something. He didn't have a mic, so I'm not even sure what he thought he was accomplishing there. I don't think I've ever seen impotence as well staged as the Democrats having Al Green shake a stick and yell something that nobody can understand, or them holding up the paddles. Either one of those two things qualifies. All the paddles with the ULI and Musk steals and all this kind of stuff. It's just absurdly childish stuff. Yeah. And Donald Trump is on there. He's in charge. And, you know, there's an old saying in politics, you know, never get in the mud to wrestle with the pig. Everybody gets dirty and the pig enjoys it. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not saying that Donald Trump is a pig, but he enjoys that type of.
Oh, yeah.
He enjoys that type of battle. And Democrats, and I mean, he was having fun with it. He was smiling. He was laughing at them. He was making fun of them.
And pointing out that there's nothing he could say that would change them.
Yeah. Which we found out when, you know, he starts introducing, you know, his guests and talks about their life stories. And you've got the 13-year-old kid who's surviving brain cancer, who gets, you know, he's hired as a U.S. Secret Service agent, incredibly, you know, nonpartisan emotion, right? And yeah. Democrats are sitting there glowering in their seat. A few of them stood, but most of them were just sitting there glowering in their seats and couldn't even bother. Couldn't even get a golf clap out of most of them. I mean, I think the, you know, Nancy Pelosi looked like she was adjusting her dentures, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Hey, look. I'm in that age range now, so I'm not making fun of the age range. But I mean, if you're sitting there doing yeah. this rather than getting up and applauding and the camera hits you, I mean, that really was clarifying. These guys will not participate unless they're in charge.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, there's a little known rule when C-SPAN broadcasts the sessions of Congress in the House and the Senate, they cannot turn the camera off of the speaker.
Yeah.
There's a rule that they fight every session. But that way, if there's a disturbance somewhere, C-SPAN cannot turn the cameras to cover that disturbance. And we saw on Tuesday night exactly why. The antics that come out when television cameras are on. You know, when you watch the Saturday football games in the fall and you see the camera when they're coming back from a timeout and the camera pans, it's on the boom cam and it swings across the stands. You see, as each person comes into range of the lens, they all go crazy. The television is this magic mood adjuster that it can do to turn people into silly people.
Yes, the kiss cam. There's always something weird that goes on with the kiss cam. Every single time I've ever seen the kiss cam. I mean, first off, it's kind of creepy. I mean, it just is.
You know? And then the guy holds up the sign. She's my sister.
She's my sister. Yeah. It's like, yeah, no, that ain't happening.
And in the CBC shows pictures of individual people during the timeouts, and they start with that cheering and booing thing. You know, they show a little kid and sitting by the glass at the rink, just this cute little kid enjoying a hockey game, and the crowd cheers. And then they show anyone else in the crowd, and everyone boos. It's so funny. I just love it. It's just...
Maybe we needed a kiss cam at the state of the, well, I know it's not technically a State of the Union address. I'm just, there's yeah, no,
come on, come no, on, Ed. Let's get silly here.
Yeah. It's a speech to the joint meeting of Congress, because they're not technically in session for that. So it's a joint meeting.
Ooh, another little piece. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes. your Uncle Pedant has just, just explained.
Sure, the pedants are revolting.
The pedants are revolting. That's right. That's exactly right. All right. But I mean, look, I mean, I thought it was a great speech. I thought he did a very good job. I didn't expect him to go as personally after Joe Biden in this speech as he did. But, you know, Joe Biden never would refer to Donald Trump by name. But I think in all four of his speeches to Congress, had something nasty to say about Trump, even while not naming him. So,
yeah,
there's a little bit of payback. I mean, it was payback for all sides. It's just that Donald Trump had the high ground.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. As well as physically. I mean, at some point, it would have been just smarter to sit there, golf clap along, and fight another day. I mean, that's a dumb place to try to, you know, to hold a contest against the president. He's got all of the advantage in that setting. And Donald Trump isn't going to be stopped by somebody heckling him. He loves that kind of stuff. I mean, it might have thrown another president off his game, but.
Yeah, you pointed out, you said it would have been smarter if they had. But that's not that crowd. that they are so afflicted by the incurable Trump derangement syndrome that they can't really control themselves when he comes into the room. It's just who they are, who they've become. He lives in their heads, and he loves it. And I have to say, it's kind of fun to watch them melt down at times. It's not good for the operation of our democracy, but it's entertaining, which is what Trump is. I mean, at bottom line, politicians are entertainers, and they entertain to get through their policies. And Trump just loves entertaining, period. He's good at it.
So, you know, I don't think Trump did any damage to himself whatsoever. One of the things that I think was most remarkable about this is that Trump focused most of his speech on 80-20 issues, right? Yeah. Places where the vast majority of Americans are behind him. And Democrats focused on the 20%. You know, I mean, Van Jones, I think it was last night or this morning, said something about this, is that Democrats have to figure out where the American people are at, because they're clearly not there. And they're making matters worse by sticking to an agenda that voters keep rejecting, and rejecting by larger and larger vote shares. And so Alyssa Slotkin, did you watch the response? Did you even watch the speech? I was thinking Andrew might be enjoying this, but maybe Andrew's smart enough not to have watched it in the first place, at least not live.
Well, I read it. I wait for the text, and then I read that, and then I watch for the parts that I saw in the reading, because it's easy to miss stuff if you're just listening. visual images come in, and then they go, and they're gone. So I like to connect the words with the images, and actually that's how I came up with the post I did last week on the speech for the audio commentary, which was the little things in Trump's speech that really revealed the guy. I mean, there were several times in that speech. If you watch the whole thing and you go, yeah, okay, fine, but if you watch it as I did, and I'm maybe the only one who did, but if you watch it for the little things that reveal the man, the values of, for instance, the kid. Now, the guests at those speeches are props to make a point. Right. And they're attached to the first lady, which in normal circumstances gets them applause. But the causes that he came up with, the people, fit the policies that he's doing. They weren't just people plucked off the sidewalk who had a nice story and they sit there. The people who illustrated what he's been doing or intends to do. And the Lake and Riley business. And it's so, it makes the guests relevant, rather than just Christmas decorations.
Right, right. And again, I mean, I think that, you know, it's a little bit like Oprah Winfrey, right?
Yeah. You know, and you look under your seat, everyone in the hall gets a new Buick.
Well, I mean, you know, he gave DJ Daniel the Secret Service position. And then he announced that the young man who was applying to West Point had his application approved, which the young man did not know. And then Jocelyn Nungaray's family, he announced apparently for the first time that he had named that wildlife preserve outside of Houston after Jocelyn Nungaray. And Jocelyn Nungaray, of course, is one of the two young women who were murdered by illegal aliens that became flashpoints over the last year or so. For the debate. Yeah. So, it was a little bit of Oprah going on there too, but yeah, he's a showman and
he's so good at it.
Yeah. It just plays right into his, it plays right into his instincts. And I have to say this. I mean, I watched all four of his State of the Union addresses in his first term, right? Because I'm paid to do that. Not because I was excited to do that, because I'm paid to do that. And I don't.
Thank you for your sacrifice.
I appreciate, thank you so much. I appreciate your appreciation. But I don't think I saw him having anywhere near as much fun in any of those four as he did this time around. I think he was ready.
Exactly. Exactly. And as he's having in the whole term so far, I mean, he's enjoying himself. He's confident. He's not uncertain about anything. Now, that can be dangerous, but for the moment, it's working great. People look at the president, and in contrast to Joe Biden, who was rarely in public view, and when he was, you had to cringe. Trump pulled it off. The contrast is powerful. I mean, he's the same age as Biden was when he came into office, and he's working. He talks about sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night. I'm not sure he's taken 4 or 5 hours off. You know, I mean, Biden took 40% of his term on vacation, and see, Trump takes Sunday off.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, he takes Sunday off, but he's mostly either, you know, in the White House or he's in Mar-a-Lago working. He's not falling asleep on the beach every single weekend.
Or the Super Bowl or NASCAR.
Exactly. I mean, the Super Bowl was during his presidency. He'd already been inaugurated.
But he went. Yeah.
Yeah. But he went and he showed up. And same thing with NASCAR. You know, he flew around the track and then landed and talked to people and stuff like that. So he's not.
And you do a flyover. He does a flyover with the Air Force One. He did that in the first term. I mean, that's just such a touch. It's just, I love it.
Well, I want to talk a little bit now about the media, because there's a media story that's out today. You sent it over to me. And we've been kind of following this a little bit, right? Which is Jeff Bezos at the Washington Post announcing that he wants his opinion section to reflect defenses of free markets and personal liberties. Now, that's a fairly wide paradigm. It's not all encompassing, though. The guy who was the opinion editor up to that point, he was offered an opportunity to continue with that mission, and I guess reportedly Bezos told him, this either has to be an enthusiastic yes or it's just a no. And the guy said no. Fine. You know, so he's on his way. I guess then we found out over the weekend or maybe on Friday that they spiked a Ruth Marcus column that criticized this. And she quit today.
That's now, not a loss.
I was just about to be nice. I was about to say, I've actually had a couple of interactions with Ruth Marcus that were nice, right? I think the first one was when I accidentally called her Ruth Cohen because I was writing about her and was it William Cohen? Was her longtime columnist there? Richard Cohen. And I accidentally called her in something I was writing. I think this was at Captain's Quarters. I wrote Ruth Cohen for some reason, and she corrected me very nicely. She sent me a note saying, I think you got this wrong. It's like, oh my God, yeah, I guess I did. And I changed it, you know, and I apologized, and she was nice about it. And she's occasionally mentioned me or contacted me a couple times about stuff that, you know, nothing significant. And here's where I land on this. I appreciate the fact that Jeff Bezos is looking around and saying, we have to change things around here. I think that there's still room, though, for a wider variety of opinions. I would just like to see a true wider variety of opinions. And I would prefer to see the change in tone, not so much in the opinion pages where I expect people to be opinionated and, you know, kind of slug things out, but in the news section, which is where I think the problem with the Washington Post actually is.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what we're getting. You sent me over this thing from Axios saying that, Washington Post overhaul newsroom structure. Now they're talking in part about the opinion stuff, but They're also now talking about the politics and national government desk, the national desk, business, tech, health, science, and climate teams. New department head roles for each new desk will be posted shortly. Now, that's actually, I think, significant change depending on who gets plugged in where on those things. What's your read on it?
Well, the legacy media and the Washington Post and the New York Times have been prime examples of this, are struggling. They still are. I think they will be for a long time. The New York Times has found a formula, and the formula is forget about being a newspaper only the way you were for so many decades and be an all-purpose publication. So they have games like the one that you play every day. They have and they have recipes and opinion columns and advice columns, people writing about all kinds of personal things that from my days on the New York Times would have been laughed at because they weren't serious news. But the fact is they have to change. They all have to change. The Washington Post has been slow to change. And it was riding on its name for a long time. Bezos bought it for $200 million. I forget what, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever it was.
No, I think it was 2013. It's been a while.
Yeah. And he just left it. And he's just left it alone. And guess what? It continued to sink. So he's come in. $200 million is nothing. It's lunch money for him. But he's come in to try to fix it. And I think because he believes it. You know, I mean, it's he's not the only big media type who has, I think Murdoch saw this a couple decades ago, but he's not the only one to realize that they have to change things and change things drastically. They lost, the Washington Post lost something like 500,000 online subscribers, which is a large number if you only have 3 million. And the New York Times, I think this is past 10 million online subscribers. You know, that's all found money for them. They don't have to buy paper, cut trees, ship the make it paper, ship it on trains, put it on trucks, take it to the printing plant, unload it, put it on printing presses, print it, put it on trucks, give it to cars, and deliver it. There's none of that anymore. It's just they have the news, they pay to collect the news, they put it online, and people pay to get it. And that's it. So the old business model is dead. The only thing left for them is by circulation, which I guess we also are. Online clicks circulation.
Yeah.
So they've got to change. And now, finally, after whatever it is, 12 years, Bezos is stepping in hands-on for his investment. I mean, he's got every right to do that, the same way the LA Times owner is changing things drastically. His LA one is in the direction more of conservative. Bezos, you know, he chummied up with Trump. I think he's at heart a liberal, but he's also at heart a businessman. And he's got to get things, the ship righted. He's got some guys in there who have been a little bit clumsy about their personnel moves, or maybe a lot of bit clumsy. I don't quite understand the description of desks, and it's kind of like moving chairs around on the Titanic deck, I think. So the proof comes in the pudding, which is what they write and publish. And I guess we'll see whether that works. They've lost a lot of talent, in my opinion, if they're not going to belong, if they're not going to go the way the team wants to go, that's fine. You know, I mean, football, there's one guy who speaks in the huddle. If there's three people saying, no, you know, we really ought to try a pass play, it's just not going to work. So Bezos is trying to assert that. He's put people in. Like the Wall Street Journal did, he's put Brits in there, and Well, I guess we'll see if it works. I wish them well, because democracy needs an honest, vital media. We don't have that right now.
No, and Patrick Soon-Shiong is another one who's not just going after the opinion sections, but talking about how news is actually reported. Now, you know, I because of the wildfires and the political firestorm that's going on out in Los Angeles, I actually picked up a subscription to the LA Times again for a while, because they were selling it for $1 a month. For 6 months. When it starts being $20 a month, I'll have to really think about whether or not I want to continue subscribing to it. But actually, I've been pretty encouraged by the way that they've reported on Karen Bass. I mean, they had I don't know if you saw this one. They had a report on Friday, wrote about it this morning. Karen Bass has set her phone to auto-delete her text messages and has had it set that way for 2 years, the entire time she's been mayor of Los Angeles. And the reason why this is an issue is because while she was in Ghana and the fires were going on, people wanted to know what was being communicated back and forth.
Yeah.
And she's saying, oh, I don't know. I don't save my texts. And I'm thinking to myself, who sets up their phone to auto-delete texts? The whole point of texting people is so you have that data that you can access. I mean, normal people want to keep those texts. I didn't even know you could delete.
That's right. That's right. It's the kind of thing that Hillary Clinton pulled off.
Yeah, I mentioned that the text had been wiped with a cloth, because that was the analogy that, you know, that came to me at the same time. But it's not even that she went back and deleted them after the fires broke out. Apparently, the entire time she's been mayor, she hasn't wanted anybody to read her text. So what does that tell you?
It tells you you're trying to hide something. I mean, it's, you know, you come into the room and people go, oh, and they turn away. You know they're hiding something. And that's exactly what she does, only she does it automatically.
But the point is that the LA Times actually reported on this. They checked it out. They reported on it. We know about it because the LA Times dug into a progressive Democrat office holder in Los Angeles, which, you know, frankly, is astonishing at this point in time. So
that's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's worth $1 a month.
I'll pay it. Yeah, I'd buy that for it at all. I was joking around about that line the other day. That's the name from RoboCop, right? I'd buy that for $1. I guess I'll do that with the LA Times too. I think that this is a signal that at least a couple of people who are outside investors in media have recognized that there is a really huge crisis with mainstream reporting media. And that's not everybody, but I think it's significant that it's the individual billionaire investor class that is realizing that they just threw a whole lot of money down the tubes unless they can rescue these institutions from themselves. And I think that that's what Soon-Shiong is doing with the Times, I think the LA Times. And I think that that's what Bezos wants to do with the Washington Post. I'm actually surprised that he's taking it this seriously. When we heard about the opinion section, I thought, first off, my first reaction was, I already subscribed to Reason. I get them in the mailbox once a month. You know, I trust their perspective on, you know, personal liberties and free markets a little bit more than I trust the Washington Post. But it seems like he's serious about going after where the real issues are, which is actually in the newsroom more than the opinion section. I'm just surprised he's in the opinion section.
Yeah. Well, I remember last fall at both of those newspapers, the trouble started when the publisher or the owner came in and said, we're not going to endorse. And of course, the staff, the liberal staff, interpreted this as can't endorse Kamala. I think they saw it more as a business decision and getting in position with Trump. But remember, the LA Times endorsed Richard Nixon for governor in 1960. Mm-hmm. And he lost, and we wouldn't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore. And the LA Times did not endorse anyone for several decades after that. They didn't endorse, period, anything. When I was there on the editorial board in the early 2000s, we were endorsing people. I was always on the losing side, but they were endorsing people, and you would expect them. I mean, there would be the usual suspects that you would think they would be endorsing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and Sun Xiong stopped them from doing an endorsement.
Yeah, he did too. Yeah. And that's what started the turmoil on the Washington Post opinion pages. But
it started in the LA Times too. The LA Times had a revolt on the staff there too. But I think Sun Xiong on top of it a little quicker than Bezos did.
And the LA Times owner paid 2.5 times as much as Bezos did for his paper.
That's true. Yeah.
Imagine having that much. You know what? I think I'll spend $500 million on this newspaper. Remember in Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, he said, I think it would be fun to run a newspaper.
Yeah. I think it'd be a pain in the ass. Actually, my own sense of, yeah, but I would still, if I had Bezos money, I'd still be tempted to do it, right?
Because of course.
Because it matters.
Right. And $200 million isn't that much to him.
Yeah, that's about, I'm trying to think of how much I pay for Amazon Prime. That's about what, 10,000 Amazon Prime?
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine told me that who we worked together on the LA Times, and he's retired now, but he says it's $1,000 a year for home delivery of the LA Times.
Yeah. It's crazy.
$1,000. I mean, they don't want home delivery anymore because it's so expensive. They get nothing for it. I mean, they get numbers on circulation, but that's it.
Well, I think they get better advertising dollars too, though, because of all the inserts that go into that, especially the Sunday.
Well, yeah. I mean, they would, but the costs of that whole network just of manufacturing a newspaper physically and then physically delivering it all before 5 a.m. is just, it's not there for them, and people weren't paying for it. But I thought, my friend's wife insists on getting it. He says, $1,000. I used to bring one home free every night.
Yeah. I mean, I don't subscribe to dead tree editions of the newspaper. No. It just accumulates. I mean, it's just, you know, I guess you can give it to the Boy Scouts for their recycling drive. It's one of the few things that actually is recyclable, you know, newsprint, right. and aluminum cans are really the two things that are actually pay for themselves through recycling. So, but you know, it kind of reminds me of Minority Report. Do you remember the film Minority Report? This is like 23 years ago, right?
No.
Steven Spielberg movie. It stars, you know, Tom Cruise, and it's about pre-crime. It's about arresting people before they actually commit the crime, so to prevent murders. It's actually kind of an interesting sci-fi film. But there's one scene in it where people are reading USA Today on the subway, right? And they're holding up the paper version of USA Today, and the headlines keep changing. It's updating in real time. And I'm thinking, you know, why would you need that? Why would you need to hold that like a paper to do that? You could just tablet. Well, we don't have to wait another 50 years to get that. We've got tablets right now that would do that if you really wanted to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, yeah.
Well, that brings us to the column.
That brings us to the column. Your column, of course, is the little things in Trump's speech that reveal the man.
No, the other one.
Oh.
The Sunday.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, this doctor helped the CIA find Osama bin Laden, Pakistan, put him in prison. Will Trump get him freed?
I think this is such an outrage.
Yeah. We should have given him asylum right off the bat. We dropped the ball in the Obama administration, Trump first term, and the Joe Biden administration.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, that's right. Obama. Yeah. Well, I mean, and then in 2012, yeah, they got Obama in 11, and in 12, an embassy official in Pakistan said, yeah, yeah, he worked for the CIA. Said, shut up.
Yeah.
I mean,
I talk.
I mean, and this is just a couple of quick anecdotes from the column. That if you don't remember or don't know the story, there's a doctor who worked as a sort of a local source in a tribal area in Pakistan. And I guess he got, a retainer or something. Anyway, he had a program to test for hepatitis B. And the CIA convinced him to take the program to Abbottabad. And then they had nurses go around and collect blood samples because they suspected that Osama was in this housing compound that there's a whole mystery involved with identifying that. And that's in the column, too. But so anyway, he confirmed that the Osama family was in that compound, and that's what led to the raid. A couple of weeks later, they arrested him, and he's been in solitary ever since on trumped up charges. Of course, they're not going to charge him with embarrassing the regime that coddled the world's most wanted man, mass murderer, and allowed him to hide in their country. So they charged him with some kind of corruption issue or whatever. And so he's in solitary and reportedly was tortured at some point. It's a guy, I guess he would be in his late 50s now or early 60s. He's got a family there. It just seems like we abandon local people who help us. We did it in Vietnam, and thousands of our allies there had to go to re-education camp or worse. Same thing happened in Afghanistan because Biden didn't believe in evacuation plans. So thousands of green card holders, thousands of Afghan allies who were promised to be removed for helping us. You know, the guys who identified IEDs and saved many American lives, they're just left there. And not only that, they didn't shred the files. So the personnel files were left there, detailed bio files. And the Taliban has been going around tracking these people down and killing them ever since. So that's on Joe Biden's conscience, if he had one. Who would help us after this? And then now comes this. It just seems like a good example. Trump has been pulling people out of prisons since he took office or trading for them in other countries. And this seems like a good example where you could get this guy and his family out and set him up somewhere with some kind of compensation. Nothing will make up for all these years in prison, but geez, it just seems like a good thing that we could pull off. I don't know why. It couldn't be just not caring. I think the government just asked Pakistan, hey, how about letting him go? And Pakistan said, screw you. So we dropped it. But I think it takes some muscle. But I hope Trump can get him out. Anyway, it's a compelling little spy story.
And people should go to Red State, get behind the paywall, become a member. This is a great time to become a member.
Oh, what is it? It's $1.63 a month now. Boy, is that a deal or what?
That's a deal. That's a deal. By the way, that's for your baseline membership, but you should really look at VIP Gold and VIP Platinum because there's a lot of benefits that go to those levels of but you know, this we keep this one outside the paywall so that everybody can watch this podcast because we've been doing it for almost 17 time. Years, right? Yeah.
A long time.
Almost 17 long years. Time. So we yeah. just had that, you know, we are for the people.
Watch out. We're going to get old someday.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We'll be like Francis Collins. Did you see him at that protest strumming his guitar, the former NIH director, no. Protesting the mass firing of bureaucrats out of the exec. Oh, do yourself a favor and just get a little tiny taste of that, but don't listen for too long. It's every bit as lame as you think it might be, which brings us, of course, to the jokes of the day.
I have one.
All right.
I have one. So as you know, on Christmas Eve, Mary and Joseph had to stay in the barn, and she was not happy at because she had told Joseph to call ahead and make a reservation, and he didn't. So they had to sleep. There was no room at the inn, so they had, and she had to have the baby in the barn. Well, they're trying to figure out a name for the new baby, Ed. I don't know if you know this story.
No, but, I don't. I haven't heard this one in theology, so I'm kind of curious.
They had tentatively settled on calling the new savior Gary, but that evening, as Joseph was walking through the barn, he stubbed his toe, and he said, "Jesus." And Mary said, "That's it. That's it. That's the name." So that's the little known story of how he got his name.
Oh, there you go. It's a little known story. Now our viewers and listeners know it. This is the reason why you tune in every week with Waldorf and Statler of the podcast world. All right, I got a quick one for you. This isn't theological, unfortunately. I didn't have time to come up with a theological joke. This is from jokesoftheday.net. The professor is giving a big test for his students, and he hands out all the tests and then goes and sits down at his desk. The test is over. The students are all coming in, handing the tests back. The professor noticed that one of the students had attached a $100 bill to his test with a note saying $1 per point. So the next day, the student gets his test back with $64 attached. As a refund. Yeah, $64. $64 was the refund on that. All right. Well, until next week, and believe me, there's going to be plenty of stuff this week to talk about next week. I can't wait till we get a chance to do that. Next week is actually going to be St. Patrick's Day. So Andrew Malcolm is going to sing Irish protest songs on the next...
I suspect you will hit the mute button for that one.
No. We're going to be doing old Irish.
Well, you can do it in Gaelic. You can sing it in Gaelic.
I might sing Moyil Amar. It's the only one I actually know. And I only really know the chorus in Irish, but I could look up the I'm not going to put anybody through that. It's a great song, by the way, but I'm not going to put anybody through that. So St. Patrick's Day next week is when we're going to be recording. And of course, it'll come out the day after that. So Andrew Malcolm, the prince of Twitter, at AH Malcolm on Twitter, the regent of redstate.com. Until then, have yourself a great week.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks, everybody. See you then.